With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay.
Huzzah. We should be in sync.
We're flying.
I'll be Timberlake.
Please don't be Timberlake.
No.
I don't
have anyone else in NSYNC, so terrible joke.
Welcome to this week's Failed Critics Podcast. I'm Steve Norman. I'm joined this week by Owen Hughes.
Hello.
And again by Maya Brooker.
Good evening.
Who we didn't put off last week with all our space porn, so she has come back.
I quite enjoyed that.
Or Owen booked her on because this is a women's special and we need a women's on it.
That, yeah, positive discrimination this week.
Like
yeah.
A token.
The token woman who can tell us to stop being so misogynistic and dominating a patriarchal society of podcasts as we are.
I still won't bloody listen.
No. I'll shrink it down to shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll do.
But yes, we are going to quiz first. And I am winning 1-0. So Owen has tried to come up the most convoluted way possible for me to lose.
Ah, yes, I have.
And he will fail.
I said on Twitter beforehand, I have emailed the rules across to you for this quiz. Because it is, I don't think it's complicated, but it needs a bit of explanation. The way it works is that essentially you start on 2 points each. And your idea is to get as close to 0 points by the end of the quiz as you can possibly be.
Right.
So you start with 2 points. You've got multiple choice questions for each right answer that you give. So each answer that's correct, I'm going to add one to your total points. For each answer that's incorrect, that's wrong, I'm going to minus 1 point from your total points. Okay? So you can go to minus numbers. So you could go all the way down by the end of the quiz. There's 10 questions. You could effectively be on -7 by the end of the quiz. Right? Or -8, I should say. But you could also end up on 12 points, if you see what I mean.
Yep.
Yes. You cannot pass on any question. You have to give an answer. And just to make things just a little bit more convoluted, there are maybe one or more trick questions in the set of questions that I've got. So if you correctly identify a trick question, which is where there is no correct answer available, then you go 2 points closer to zero from whatever position you are. If you guess a trick question when it's not actually a trick question, you go 2 points further away from zero.
What happens in that case if you're on one or minus one?
Well, if you're on minus one and you claim trick question when it's not a trick question, you go to -3. So you go 2 points further away.
No, if you get that right, you said you go
up to 2 points closer. So if you're on minus one, you'll go to zero, straight to zero.
Right. Trying to catch you out on your rules already.
No, I've thought it through. I've literally tested it out already. So it should work. The only other thing that happens is if you don't identify a trick question, then you move 1 point further away from zero. That's the rules. Hopefully quite straightforward. I think it's clear. You start on 2 points. Right answer moves you closer. Wrong answer... No, right answer adds one to your score. Wrong answer minuses one.
And if you don't get the crystal in the allotted time, you're locked in the room.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You've got it. Yeah. Okay. Right. So it's multiple choice, as I say. First question. And you both get the same questions and you can decide which one you want to go for. According to Oh, I should also say, this is all based on statistics that I've gathered personally. Like, I had an assignment to do at university, which involved gathering statistics and turning it into stories and stuff. I've taken all of this information from the Box Office Mojo Top 100 Highest Grossing Films list. So, with that in mind, according to statistics on Box Office Mojo, which of the following franchises has more films in the top 100 highest grossing films of all time in the US? Is it Shrek? Is it Despicable Me? Or is it X-Men? And Steve, you can guess first. So if you give a correct answer, you go to 3 points. An incorrect answer will take you down to 1 point.
Okay. I'm going to say Despicable Me.
You're going to say Despicable Me? Okay. And Maya?
I think I'm going to go with Shrek.
Okay. I can tell you the correct answer is Shrek with 3 films, which means Maya got it correct, but is now up to 3 points. And Steve is on to 1 point. See how it works? It's quite clear? Excellent. So, how many of the top 100 highest grossing films in the US were released in 3D? Is it 55, 45 or 35? And Steve, as you're still in front, you can go first again.
I'm going to say 55.
I'm going to say 55. Okay, and Maya? You can guess the same answer if you wanted to.
45 I'll go with.
The correct answer was 35, so you've both dropped a point, which means Steve is now on 0 points. Steve is closest to zero, in effect. And Maya is, of course, down to 2 points. Assuming profit to be the film's domestic gross minus its budget, right? Which film only made $9.4 million profit, but is also the highest in the top 100 highest grossing films of all time? Is it Man of Steel, Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End, or The Amazing Spider-Man? And Steve, you're still ahead, so it's up to you to pick.
I would say...
It doesn't matter whether you get it right or wrong, you're going to move a point either way on this one. Unless you think it's a trick question.
I would say this is a trick question.
You're going to say it's a trick question?
I reckon it's a trick question. How many trick questions are in the whole
thing? I'm not telling you.
I reckon this is a trick question.
Okay. And Maya?
I'm going to go with Man of Steel.
Man of Steel. I can tell you the correct answer was Pirates of the Caribbean. It wasn't a trick question, Steve. So now you have shot behind. You are on either... Well, do you want 2 points or minus 2 points? I'll let you choose.
Why does he get a choice?
Because he's on zero. So he goes 2 points further away, whichever direction he likes. So if you think you can get them correct or incorrect...
I'll have 2 points.
2 points. Okay, yeah. So Maya, you're on to 1 point and you are now ahead.
Excellent.
And just to clarify on that, Pirates of the Caribbean, the lowest by far in terms of profit made at $9.4 million. You know, considering it grossed over like $300 million, I should say. Yeah, $300 million. It's a tiny amount, just a tiny amount. Right, judging solely by the number of films in the top 100 list, which month has been the most lucrative in terms of domestic gross from 1975 to present? Is it May, June or December? And Maya, you are currently in the lead. So which one do you think or not think?
So I need to guess a wrong number.
You need to guess a wrong answer for this one.
Okay.
Unless you think it's a trick question.
No, I don't think it's a trick question. I'm going to go with December.
Okay, and Steve?
Is this US?
Yeah,
domestic.
US only. US, yeah. That's it.
I reckon December as well.
You reckon December as well?
Mm.
So is that... Okay. Well, you're both wrong. So you get minus one off each of your scores, which means Maya is now on zero and Steve is on one. The tide has shifted. May is the most... is the best month to release a movie, basically. So... So as we know, May is the most profitable month, but which film in the top 100 list grossed the most domestically of these three? Was it The Matrix? Was it Raiders of the Lost Ark or was it Back to the Future? And Maya, you are still in the lead.
I'm going to go with Matrix.
And Steve?
I am also going to say The Matrix.
You're going to say The Matrix as well? Well, I can tell you it was a trick question. None of those were actually in the top 100. So you both move a point further away, which means Steve is up to two. And Maya, do you want to go to minus one or up to one?
Up to one, please.
Up to one. Okay. No one's down to minus figures yet. Right. Across all of the 100 films on the list, what is the average IMDb rating for these films? And by average, I mean the mean value. Is it 6.4, 6.9, or 7.4? And it's still you, Maya, who is closest to zero.
I'm going to go with 7.4.
Okay. And Steve?
I'm going to go with 6.9.
And the answer was 7.4. So Maya's up to two and Steve is down to one. And yeah, shifting again. The exact figure was 7.442. Just in case you were wondering. So which of the three films on the top 100 list, or which of these three films, I should say, is closest to the 7.4 IMDb rating? Is it Finding Dory? Is it Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets? Or is it Avengers Age of Ultron? And Steve, you are now in the lead.
Finding Dory.
Okay. And Maya?
I'm going to go with Age of Ultron.
Well, it was another trick question because they are all 7.4 exactly on IMDb. There was not one that was the closest. So plus one to both of you on that question. Both Titanic and Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, won 11 Oscars each. However, which of the following three received the most Oscar nominations? Was it Gravity? Was it Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring? Or Avatar? So, Steve, you're ahead.
I am going to say Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring.
Okay. And Maya, Gravity, Fellowship of the Ring or Avatar?
I think the same, Fellowship of the Ring.
Well, I can tell you that Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring is the correct answer. So you've both gone up a point, which means Steve is on three and Maya is on four going into the final question. It's all to play for. And I do have a tie break, Steve, before you say anything.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I only say it out of past failures.
Yeah. Right. George Lucas is the top grossing film director of all time, with his movies in the top 100 list alone grossing a total of over $1.6 billion. But only one of the following directors is also in that top 10 alongside George. Who is it? Is it James Gunn? Is it Sam Raimi? Or is it Colin Trevorrow? And Steve, you get to answer first.
I think Sam Raimi.
Okay. And Maya? So you remember you're guessing for the one you don't think grossed.
I'm going to go with a trick question.
You're going to go with trick question?
Yeah, I may as well.
Okay, well, it's not a trick question, which means you get plus 2 points to your score.
Oh, bollocks.
And you're on six. And Steve is on four. He also gets plus one because the answer was Sam Raimi. He's ninth on the list for Spider-Man, Spider-Man 2 and Spider-Man 3. There you go. James Gunn is 17th. And Colin Trevorrow is 18th. So, final scores. Steve is 4. Maya is 6. Which means Steve wins this quiz.
Ha ha.
Ha ha, yes.
What convoluted rules are you going to come up with next week for me to try and lose? Because if I win next week, you're watching something crap. What will you do?
Yeah. If people really dislike that quiz, I won't do it next
Tough
week.
Tough luck.
Yeah, but otherwise, I might use it again next week because I quite like how that works. I might repeat
I'd try and find something that I'm going to lose at, mate. I'm going to find something awful for you to watch.
I've already told you, haven't I? I've found five films that are all lined up one after the other that I'm going to make you watch when I next win five quizzes.
All I need to do is find out who gave you that idea. Find out what they suggested and make you watch them.
It wasn't a suggestion from anyone you'll find on Twitter or Facebook or anywhere else online.
Well, there we go. Anyway, so that's the quiz that I'm winning 2-0 going into next week. One bit of news that we would like to touch on, and that is today, Monday, the day of recording, Peter Salis sadly passed away. He, if you don't know his name, he is most famous for being in Last of the Summer Wine, the famous British sitcom for those foreign listeners that we have. But also, he was most well known, especially in his later years, for being the voice of Wallace in the popular claymation Wallace and Gromit. I think partly it's to pay tribute to him in that role. This bit of news, this news item, and partly to pay tribute to Wallace and Gromit. I think it's something that we've actually overlooked on this podcast in the 5 years or whatever we've been going. We've never really spoken about it.
Yeah, it seems a bit strange, I guess, when we're starting our women's special podcast. That sounds terribly patronising. That's not what I mean. But because we're doing Wonder Woman.
If a woman had died today, it was worth talking about. We would have spoke about them, but none of them did. They all had the good grace to keep living.
But it's not... Wallace and Gromit is not particularly known for its female characters, is it? You know, it's written by a bloke. It's about a quirky bloke and his dog.
Who's a boy dog.
A boy dog. True.
We assume.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Gromit could be a bitch. We don't know.
I don't think Gromit is a female.
No, I don't think so.
I think Gromit's a he as well. But
yeah.
Maybe that's just, you know, society placing a gender on Gromit, and Gromit is actually... No, anyway, let's not go there.
No, it's not.
But you're right. It is something that we've never really talked about in great detail. I guess for each of us, it's something we remember from when we were younger.
Well, I brought this up when we were talking before we started recording, and what was it? A Grand Day Out was first aired on television Christmas Eve 1990.
Crazy, isn't it? So
it makes it like, yeah, a lot older than what I thought. Like, over 25 years old is Wallace and Gromit. And I just didn't think it was as old as that.
It's amazing.
But it's so... All of the Wallace and Gromit... So we've had The Grand Day Out... The Wrong Trousers, A Close Shave, Cracking Contraptions, the feature-length movie Curse of the Were-Rabbit, and I'm sure there's been some other bits and pieces as well that he's voiced Wallace in. They've all just been really... They're charming, they're funny, they're incredibly well-made because the art of claymation movie making is just phenomenally painstakingly difficult and time-consuming. They're brilliantly voiced. I mean... Even though Gromit doesn't say anything, he just says everything with a look.
Yeah.
And it's just fantastic. And I can't believe it's something we've actually overlooked for so long on this podcast.
I think it's timeless too. You
know, yeah, there's no... Yeah,
generation after generation of people can really, really enjoy it and it still be really funny.
It's very British, isn't it?
Yes.
I believe it's popular around the globe.
In the way that I think a lot of these very British things are, because they're kind of kitsch and you know, it appeals,
little quirky,
I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, something like The Wrong Trousers with that evil penguin is just fantastic.
But then, like, Aardman have built up a global reputation anyway. You know, stuff like The Pirates in An Adventure with Scientists was really popular.
Well, I've not seen that, but
no, I don't think I have.
That's apparently really good as well.
It's okay. I mean, I kind of like it. It's not up to Wallace and Gromit.
No.
But, you know, we were talking as well about Shaun the Sheep, which is another one that was really popular almost everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's got like 99% on Rotten Tomatoes. So
it is brilliant.
And didn't Aardman also do that, the creature comforts thing, which they is did. Just like a little...
Yes, they yeah. did, didn't they?
But yeah, obviously we're talking about Peter Sallis and Wallace and Gromit, because I don't think any of us know too much about Last of the Summer Wine, other than its,
no.
other than its popularity and the fact that it ran for nearly 30 years.
Yeah, wasn't it like the longest running British sitcom or something like that?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure if it stopped being a regular thing and went to specials after a while, but it ran from 73 to 2010. So, and he was apparently, from what I heard on a radio interview earlier today, he was the only person in every single episode.
Which is some feat, isn't it?
That is, yeah.
Yes, yeah. It's incredible. But yeah, just going back to it, he is iconic for that voice of Wallace.
Yeah.
You just associate with him straight away. And if someone says Wallace, and you can hear his sort of, like, you can hear that voice in your head straight away. And when you think about that, who else could voice that character and make it sound just right?
Well, I was thinking about that, but he's got one of those voices that's so impressionable, you know, impersonable. People can, you know, I don't know, Alistair McGowan or someone like that could do it. You know, anyone who's really good at impersonating that voice could. Because it's one of those that, you know, impressionists just roll out all the time, isn't it? You know, they're all Gromit and then that kind of... Obviously, I'm not going to do it because I'm terrible at impersonations.
I think you should.
I don't think so. I really don't think so.
Go on, give us a cheese Gromit or something like that.
I don't do tricks, Steve. I don't...
No?
No.
No?
No, not like that.
But yeah, I think Wallace and Gromit's fantastic, and it's a shame that we might not even get any more now. Obviously, it's more of a shame that he's passed away, and thoughts go out to his family and friends, etc. But you know, the fact we might not get any more now is just a bit of a sad thing as well, because they're so good.
I know what you're thinking. This isn't the usual failed critics jingle, but I like it. Well, it is, of course, the theme music to our fortnightly sister gaming podcast, Character Unlock, hosted by Andrew Brooker.
We might want to talk about some game stuff, mate.
And John Miller.
I didn't enjoy episode one, and I didn't enjoy the first minute and a half of episode two. I just thought, fuck it.
And in their upcoming podcast, they'll be previewing the E3 conference. And then from the 11th of June, you'll be getting the full 30-minute audio breakdown of each conference over the 3 days. That's the latest from Microsoft, Bethesda, Nintendo, EA, Ubisoft, and Sony. Probably talking about games and that, I assume. Subscribe to the Failed Critics podcast feed on iTunes or whatever podcast app you choose, or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Character Unlock. Now, on with the show.
In this part of the podcast, we're going to change things up slightly and review this week's major new release, Wonder Woman, the latest part of the DC Cinematic Universe, starring Gal Gadot, I never know, as the title character of Wonder Woman, and it's an origin story, really, isn't it? We've seen her in Batman versus Superman as kind of not a cameo, but a very secondary role, but now she's got her own film. And she's very much front and centre in this one, as we find out where she came from and her backstory.
Yeah, because there's a great... I watched Batman vs. Superman again the other day, and...
Poor you.
I still think it's fine. I still think it's okay. But, like, there's a bit at the end where Batman and Superman turn to each other when Wonder Woman shows up to fight Doomsday. Spoiler! And then they both go, oh, I thought she was with you. Because she just turns up in that film. And I think that's very much how she's, you know, it's very fitting because that's all she is, that supporting character that's just plonked into the story for no reason really, other than to set up Wonder Woman. And it is quite a cool moment when she turns up in Batman versus Superman, I think. And, you know, you get to hear a theme tune, and which is quite funky, the Junkie XL thing. And it's great, but this really is now the film where you get all of the character out of it. You get to see, it is an origin story, but it's more than just telling you this is where she came from. You know, this is all about putting all of that character into her that was completely absent in the more flashy, showy offy Batman versus Superman, which for me worked really well. I think everything to do with Diana Prince, to give her her alias, it actually works very well indeed. And I know it's saying like I'm struggling to praise it, but that's only because it's getting so much praise. Like, people absolutely fawning themselves over this. And I understand why. And I think it's, if people genuinely love it that much, then that's fantastic. That's great. And I'm really pleased that it's turning the tide on DC movies. And, you know, because I still keep sticking up for them. And I think now Wonder Woman's probably the most well-crafted one yet. Although I still really prefer Man of Steel. But, you know, anyway, I'm waffling. I did like Wonder Woman. What I want to ask you guys is, first of all, your opinion on the previous three DC Extended Universe movies. So that's Man of Steel, Batman vs. Superman, and Suicide Squad. I think we heard you a couple of weeks ago talking about these, Steve. So, yeah. Maya, what do you think of the DC films thus far?
I think they're all right, actually. I think they're average. I think my best one out of all of the three that you've mentioned is Suicide Squad, and that's purely on the basis that it's just a lot of fun. I liked Batman vs. Superman more than some people, mm-hmm. so I thought it was a good film. It was fun. Mm-hmm. And there were some serious flaws in it, but I still liked it. And just like you said about Wonder Woman turning up, I was very, very happy when she turned up in that. And as soon as her theme tune kind of went on, I was like, this is awesome. Suddenly, Batman versus Superman felt a little bit like a better film. Man of Steel, I still quite liked. I did like them all. I thought they were pretty good. Yeah.
So Wonder Woman, then, for you, where does it kind of sit in terms of, you haven't got to rank it amongst the others, but you loved it? Okay, great.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun, and it really did build her character and set up. Yes, it was an origins film, so it did everything what I expected it to do, but I really, really enjoyed it. I might be a little bit biased because I love Wonder Woman. She's my ultimate favorite superhero. Especially in the DC world. But I thought it was really, really good. And Gal Gadot, she's amazing. I think I'm a bit in love with her now, I think.
I think it definitely did that on purpose. I wrote a review of this and posted it online today, and I can't remember exactly what I said. Read the review, people. Go and read the review. But I said about, like, they made her into this, like, stunning woman.
Yeah.
Not in terms of, hey guys, look at this. It was done very much intentionally as, this is what a woman's idea of a heroic superwoman is.
Yes. And, yeah.
Well, I mean, what for me, one of the most impressive things about the film was, considering what she was wearing for the whole thing, there was no gratuitous art shots.
Yeah. Not a single upskirt shot. Take note. Zack Snyder.
Yeah, which there was in Batman versus Superman.
Yeah.
And considering, like I said, her outfit is pretty revealing to an extent.
Yeah.
I don't know what Amazonian warrior women would actually wear if they were real, if that is practical battle dress. I don't know. I'm not an expert on these things. But it would, in some films, as we've just said, with ones that Zack Snyder made, it is quite easy to get. It would be quite easy to get, with what she's wearing in it, a few arse shots or crotch shots in there, because, you know, even in a fight scene, where, you know, they didn't
over-sexualize her.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
There was, she worked, the director, Patty Jenkins, worked with a costume designer called Lindy Hemming, who is, she worked on the Christopher Nolan Batman films as well. So she kind of had an idea about how, you know, superhero costumes should look and how they work on screen and stuff. Mm. But they, Patty Jenkins and Lindy Hemming both got together and thought, what can we do to make her look like an Amazon, like a proper badass. And they thought about what the kind of things that they wanted to show off. Now, I think if you had a male director, and I know there was, you know, a lot of male influence on the film anyway, in terms of the writers and, you know, the producers and so on. But they basically thought, well, we want to show off her ripped shoulders and toned legs, right? That's what they went for.
I suppose because she's quite a slight built woman, you've got to kind of make her look convincingly warrior-like.
Yeah.
Mm.
So if she has got toned shoulders and strong legs, you need to show them or show some aspects of her physicality to make
exactly.
it look like she's a convincing... Yeah. Convincingly yeah. could stand up for herself in a fight.
Yeah, there was a quote from Jenkins. She says, as a woman, I want Wonder Woman to fight and look great at the same time. In my opinion, this means she has really long legs. So there's still like there's still some thought in there about, well, what makes her look attractive and what makes her look desirable. But I don't think it's desirable in a, you know, I want to shag her kind of no. way. It's a, I want to emulate that. I think
it's as well making her look convincingly like a fighter.
They do make her look powerful.
If she's wearing like sleeves and trousers, you're not going to get that sense of if her, you know, if she's got any muscle definition or anything. If she's like, well, she actually throw a punch. Look at how she's built.
But this is like this is interesting because, like, I don't know if you remember before Batman versus Superman, and they cast Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman, as Diana Prince. And there was a little bit of a backlash online saying, why have you cast this, like, really quite skinny woman to play Wonder Woman? You know, there was a lot of talk of, like, choosing...
What they want, the bloody woman who played Xena?
Well, yeah, that's kind of what they've gone for, in a way, because Gal Gadot has kind of built herself up to look athletic, you know?
Yeah.
Her physique in this is... Well, they make her look really tall. She looks really, like, as Maya just said, she looks really powerful. I honestly think, in hindsight, those critics should probably...
Shut the fuck
you
up.
Know, swallow their own words. Yeah, shut the fuck up, because she's really nailed it. You know, I think this one thing that DC have gotten right over these films is the casting. If you think of, like, the main stars, Henry Cavill, a lot of people doubted him as Superman. I actually think he turned out to be really good.
I really do like him, yeah.
Yeah, Ben Affleck as Batman. Do you remember the uproar about that?
Yeah.
People complaining about Ben Affleck as Batman. And then, you know, so many reviewers afterwards claimed he was the best thing about the film. Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn.
Yeah.
Fantastic casting.
I do like the casting of this. I think she's brilliant. I think, you know, the power in her arms and leg is shown well. She's not overly sexualized. She looks powerful. And yet, at the same time, she looks feminine and... I honestly think she was brilliant. And you're right, the casting. I think they did a really good job because, she is quite slim. And, yes, they want her to look like an Amazon warrior, but that doesn't mean that she needs to be built like a, you know...
Yeah, precisely.
Brick shit house.
Yeah, she doesn't have to be Arnie in a skirt. She's
no,
just got,
exactly.
You know,
I mean, there were a few Arnies in a skirt on the island with the Amazons.
Yes.
Stronger built women than her back there.
But, you know, at the same time, she is basically, you know, a goddess warrior.
Yeah.
So that's part of the character anyway, is that she's going to stand out. But
I mean, it doesn't matter whether it's a male or female role. In a lead role in a film of this ilk, it's always going to be someone good looking.
That is true. Yeah. And they make a point of that with Chris Pine, right?
Let's be honest. It doesn't matter if it's a Marvel film, a DC film, a male superhero film, a female superhero film, your Guardians of the Galaxy, where it's an ensemble cast. The main roles aren't going to be going to ugly people, are they? Let's be honest.
No.
They are conventionally attractive.
And it doesn't matter if they sexualise the character or not, or get them in revealing clothes, or have the man with his top off for half the film, or not, or if he's, you know, fully clothed and in a bat suit for the whole film. It doesn't matter. They're always going to pick somebody who the audience will find physically and aesthetically pleasing.
Well, the ultimate example of that is always Hugh Jackman as Wolverine, isn't it? Meant to be a short, squat, hairy, ugly little man, and then they cast, like, beautiful Hugh Jackman
He is beautiful. Yes, yeah, I agree with that one. I think I do. Yeah, the casting is good, and they have to be aesthetically pleasing and
precisely
and appealing to people. Otherwise, people are not going to watch it. Really.
And the other thing that works about her being like looking the way that she does in this film is she's in a very ugly world. You know, she's in. Yeah. I mean, obviously Chris Pine is there and whatever, but you know, she's in this horrible war-torn environment because the whole film takes place in the First World War, the Great War. Almost the whole film does anyway. You've got a bit at the beginning and at the end which are like the present day, and you've got a lot of it on Themyscira. I can't remember how you pronounce the place. The island, the island from Lost. Yeah. Yeah, the Amazonian sort of paradise where all these women live before they're invaded. They meet the real world. And I think that works really well to show this paradise, which is full of all these bright, vibrant colours. And it was a nice contrast. And I think part of the contrast, again, is like if you look at it in terms of the themes of the film, it's all this like idyllic place where, women are really independent and they don't need men and it's really nice and isn't it lovely and stuff. But actually deep down underneath that is this like destructive, chaotic force that's scary.
Yeah, and no one can open jam jars. And
change light bulbs.
But what happens is she goes into the world of men, and that's when it's all this like oppressive visualization stuff going on, right? You know, it goes all grim and dark, and it goes like when she goes to London, and it's all just full of smoke and industrial stuff. I think it's purposefully done that way to show she literally steps into the world of men, you know, or sails into it, I guess.
And they don't really make too much of any romantic relationship between Chris Pine's character, Steve Trevor, and Wonder Woman either, do they? I mean, there's obviously something there, but it's not like they're pining, forgive the pun, and sort of chasing each other. There's no kind of... There is one scene, but there's no, you know, they're not constantly chasing after each other. And
even that one scene, though, is only... If you see it as a romantic scene, that's your choice to do that. It's not even it's not actually shown as being romantic. It's if you want to see it that way, that's entirely fair.
You could look at it as they're just good friends, or they're in a situation together where they respect each other's,
as
partners.
And it's not they're obviously friends at a minimum, but they never kind of force this kind of romantic angle. Which maybe you could say of other superheroes. Ant-Man, he gets... Obviously, is there some romantic thing with him and Evangeline Lilly's character? That's the kind of most obvious one I can think of on top of my head at the moment of recent superhero films.
I think it's quite interesting, actually, in terms of how people receive the Batman film and the, you know, Superman film and Suicide Squad, in terms of... They've always... And it's... understandable why, but they're always compared to the Marvel films. And I think if Wonder Woman does anything, it highlights, like, in comparison to the Marvel films, just how formulaic they are becoming, or have been, even, you know. Obviously, you get exceptions which are slightly different. Guardians of the Galaxy 2, I would say, doesn't really follow that conventional pattern. But Doctor Strange, Ant-Man...
a lot of the films they're releasing, Marvel, recently, have been... There's been quite a few origin stories, but they are very formulaic.
Yeah.
You're introduced to a character, you find out how they get their powers, they get into a situation, there's a bad guy, they beat them.
It's a rise and fall, and then a rise again. Yeah, that's the way they all work. And I don't think Wonder Woman necessarily does that either. It's all about a journey, about sort of discovery. I think it's about identity as well. And one of my favourite things about it is, you know, obviously it uses love and it uses war quite a lot throughout the film to make lots of different points. But one of the best things about it, and it was like as you were watching it, you know, I said in the review as well, I'm just a 30-year-old kind of working-class guy from the Midlands in the UK. There's nothing really in this film that's directed to me specifically, and I'm okay with that. I think it's fine. But even I was watching this and going, yeah, right on, you tell them what to, you know, where to go. Because a lot of the time she's told no, you know. Yeah. Lots of times, lots of different people, whether it's a mum in the early part of the film when she wants to be a warrior and her mum says no, and then she does it anyway. Yeah. You get all the British guys who say no and she just does it anyway.
But the thing is with most of this is that she's not being told no because she's a woman.
Well, I think she is. I think that's part of it.
I don't know, because her mum's telling her no because she's like forged by Zeus from clay, and she wants to protect her, doesn't she? She's a power. It's not because she's a woman. It's because she's powerful and she's.
But she wants to stop her becoming powerful. Is the thing, because she's her daughter. So it's about. It's not about male particularly. Dominance.
No,
it's about
you know, in the trenches they want to stop her going into no man's land because that's fucking stupid.
Yeah.
I mean, all right, yeah. she's a powerful being with special powers and weapons, she can survive it. But they don't really know that. Walking out into no man's land is a bit daft.
Yeah, obviously. But then there's all stuff.
So it's
in
not
like
it's not because don't go into no man's land because you're a woman. Don't go into no man's land because chances are you'll tread in a mine and blow yourself up.
But there's like in the war room, right? She's in the war room in London and she walks in and they're like, she shouldn't be in here. Tell her to get out. And Chris Pine has to say...
Yeah, there's a few bits like that, aren't there?
Granted, but that's what society was like in... 1980, whatever. If it was happening, if it was set modern day and that was happening, well, yes, that would be ridiculous. But as it was said, that's what the attitude was like. You can't overrule history to make it something it wasn't.
But they've chosen to put that in there for a reason. You know, they didn't have to include scenes like that. And I think that the point of the scene is Diana is told no all the time, and it doesn't matter
But they needed a reason that she wasn't being listened to then.
Yeah, exactly. But it's just to show that, you know, her strength of character is. She's told not to do stuff, and it's almost always because people are scared, people are trying to cover other things. You know, David Thewlis is great in this as Sir Patrick, who
is
constantly trying to manipulate her into doing what he wants, really. And I think that it's the fact that she sees through all of this. You know, she's told to get out of the room, so she walks backwards and then just walks back in again. You know, it's like James Cosmo telling her, who is this woman? She can't read. What does she think she's doing reading this like Ottoman language thing? Just tell her, you know, get her out of here. It doesn't even talk to her, yet she stays.
I think for me that the character is, you know, she's being told no. It's not always because she's a woman. But I think it helps develop her a little bit as well, because it makes, you know, she's, as an Amazon in the island, she's quite innocent. And then suddenly, you know, all these things are happening and it just opens up her eyes to the world that she stepped into.
Saying all this, though, about how much we liked the film, I still don't think it was great. I think it was good. I think people might think it's better than what it is because, A, it's the best that DC have put out yet, in my opinion. And probably many people's opinion. B, Gal Gadot was very good in it. And C, sends out quite a positive message with regards to female role models and female taking lead roles in films, especially superhero films, because as of yet, we've not seen a female-led superhero movie in either Marvel or DC or anything that Fox have done, or universe, anyone, you know, it's been Fantastic Four, so it's been a co-lead, or Guardians has been a co-lead, or, Scarlet Witch or Black Widow haven't got their own standalone movies yet, and nothing in the pipeline. I think Captain Marvel is going to be a Marvel film with a female lead, and that's going to be the first one. That's some years away yet. So they've either been co-leads or secondary characters, and this is obviously a female lead in a big superhero film front and centre, and it's giving out quite a positive message and it's been done very well. It's been directed by women as well. So I think those things are leading some people to think the film is perhaps better than what it is, which is a bit of a negative thing to say, but you can say that about a lot of different things because things might be doing, something might be doing the right things in terms of the message they're putting across. Is films in general about anything? They're putting across the right message. They're putting the right kinds of people in the right kinds of roles, or being made by the right kind of people. People then kind of, if you were scoring the film, would bump it up a mark. If they think it would have been ordinarily a 7, they might put it up to an 8. And for me, that's kind of... I don't think it was a great film. It was a good film. It was enjoyable. I still wasn't totally gripped by it.
It's all right, Steve. It's all right. You can stop squirming. We know what you're getting at. I don't necessarily... I haven't seen anybody do that. Anyone I've followed on Twitter... or anyone I've like checked Letterboxd on, or haven't really read any, you know, major media source reviews or anything for it. But you know, all the little things I've seen in the comments, I haven't seen anyone who I think has rated it higher because it's quite PC.
I don't think they're saying that they're rating it higher because of that, and maybe even consciously they're not doing it. But I think perhaps there is a bit with some people that think, you know, if you said to them this film was actually directed by a man, then they wouldn't actually be as positive about it. I genuinely think that, and this might sound completely wrong. It's not me disparaging the film. I didn't think it was a great film. I thought it was a good film. It's by far the best DC film. It's better than some of the Marvel films. But I wasn't, you know, overly enthralled by it. I wasn't totally gripped by it, but I did enjoy it. I just think some people are perhaps overhyping it because of the message it's putting across and who's made it, the central character in it and who plays it, and perhaps even how good she is in it, despite the film not being that good or as good, but she was brilliant in it.
I still don't know if that's true. I mean, I've certainly seen... Well, Twitter's just like, you know, the playground of fucking nincompoops. But I have seen people attacking other people for not being particularly complimentary about Wonder Woman. I think there's probably an element of people being quite defensive about it for those reasons that you've pointed out.
Yeah, there is that.
But
as
I don't
well.
Think that necessarily means that. I don't think that necessarily means that those people who are doing that don't like the film as much as they are claiming to. I'm much more comfortable in saying I've seen aggressively defensive twat bags on Twitter more so than I've seen people inflating their opinion. Because even the people I know that have been very positive about it and have praised the film for various aspects have still... I mean, I haven't seen many give it an absolute full-on 4 or 5 star kind of review. Mm. Most people have said it's good. This is why it's good. But bear in mind, these are the issues, and they are still issues that have permeated through most of the DC movies, which tends to be, it's just a bit uneven. And I don't think it's boring at any point. I'm not saying it's boring. I think the film is, it's got a lot of good pieces, set pieces there, you know.
Yeah.
There's lots of, like, oomph and pizzazz. And, you know, the No Man's Land scene in particular is the standout set piece in the entire movie. But it still has the ultimate destruction big CGI fight at the end, as all DC movies seem to clamour towards, despite constantly being told, just stop it. Just stop.
It's that formula again, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's this big, ever-long CGI fist fight that just... I mean, I get it. You've got a superhero. There's no way that they're going to sit down at the end of the film and just talk it out and then sign a bit of paper and say, I won't do that again. And they say, good, because you'll get in trouble. And they go, okay, I won't do it again. But it has to end in this big, calamitous, chaotic showdown. But there are other ways of doing that than big... CGI, grey, kind of indistinguishable things being just smashing into each other, throwing tanks at each other, big flames going off all, you know, explosions all around them, and having it last like 15, 20 minutes. At least in Wonder Woman, it's turned down a bit. The dial is down slightly. But it's still that same problem.
Yeah.
I mean, I was watching it thinking, you know, do you know what would be a cool ending for this? War movies don't end. You know, you watch old classic war movies, which is kind of, is in a way, you know, it's set during that period. It's a kind of combat movie. They don't all have massive explosions. They don't all end with war. They end with like a bit of an uplifting triumph.
Have either of you two seen the 1975 TV series of Wonder Woman with Linda Carter?
No, probably the odd episode
This is where all my love for Wonder Woman kind of comes in, because I remember watching on a Sunday afternoon, watching reruns on the reruns. I'm not that old. on the TV, sitting down with family Sunday afternoon, having food and just watching it, and I absolutely loved Wonder Woman from that point. She was so powerful, and Gal Gadot just reminded me of the way Linda Carter did it. It was just absolutely, you know, there's a lot of power in there, there's a lot of strength. There's, you know, you just kind of almost sit in awe of the way they've done that. You know, they're like most superhero films. There's moments where I will always, you know, eye roll and go, oh, that's just so ridiculous. But this one, yeah, and the TV series as well, I absolutely loved it. It's just something that I always remember from my childhood with my family. And it's probably one of the reasons why I love Wonder Woman so much, is because of the way Linda Carter was Wonder Woman, and how Gal Gadot seems to have done it. Maybe not in the same way, but in another really, really kind of inspirational way, I think, for me.
That's quite, yeah, I mean, that's good, because that's kind of like a perspective on it that I just don't think Steve and I can really have in the same way. I mean, we, in terms of superheroes, well, sticking with Wonder Woman, my main, like, history with Wonder Woman has only come through comic books, and I've never liked her solo comics. I've only ever liked the stuff where she's with other superheroes. I think mainly because the new 52 stuff was quite good, but that's the same writer, the guy who wrote that comic also wrote this film. But anyway, the main issue I always had with the comic books is the art in it, and it's always about looking, you know, as good as the stories are, it's always about you are looking at, you know, this woman in very tight clothes, you know, see every curve on her backside. You can see, you know, a breast stick out a fucking mile in front of her. And I just think it's always just a bit sleazy. It's always just a little bit sleazy. And so I think what they did really well in introducing Wonder Woman in this film, obviously you have her at the start, and she looks really glamorous and everything, but it goes to Wonder Woman as like an 8-year-old girl, and the first thing you see is just a beaming smile as she's running down the street.
Yeah,
I thought that's a really nice way to introduce this. You're doing an origin, but you're not doing the, you know, 17-year-old, good looking, but kind of, you know, barely legal sort of avenue, which is good. I like that it was introduced with a little girl. I think that it just sets the tone perfectly.
Yeah, I was grinning like an idiot when watching the bit where she's mirroring the fighting. I absolutely loved that, because I just sat there thinking, yeah, she's awesome. I hope I was like that when I was a little girl, and, you know, I hope Nikita will be like that. But and I'm not saying that the 1970s show didn't over-sexualized Wonder Woman, because it was the 70s, so they probably did.
Part of it, yeah. She was a secretary. Yeah. And,
well, it follows the same story as the origins with Steve Trevor, and you know, how he kind of comes across the Amazon island and everything. But it for me, and I think that's, again, you know, it might be just because I'm a woman, but it is really, really empowering. And just to go, well, yes, she's absolutely beautiful. Yes, there is an element of her being sexualized, but actually, she'll kick anyone's ass if she needs to. And that's what I found, what I loved about Wonder Woman, the film as well as the TV series, and the character themselves. You know, they're not, especially, you know, when you see all the Amazons, they're not sitting there all being beautiful and bathing and all of that kind of stuff. They're, you know, you see them, you introduce them fighting. and training and being warriors. And I found that really, really kind of powerful.
Sure. Mm. I think it's very powerful imagery. I think one... Okay, so the other thing that I think lets it down a little bit is in terms of the villains. Like, because she's chasing Ares, the god of war, and you kind of left to go, oh, I wonder who Ares is, but you kind of know who he is all along, right? I think it's pretty obvious from the get-go what's going on. But they make out that that what's happening is she's chasing Ares. The Germans are the bad guys because they are corrupted by Ares, who's making them do bad things, right? And so she's chasing after Ares. Steve Trevor suggests that Ares could be Ludendorff, who is the German captain, who's played by Danny Houston, and his chemist sidekick, Dr. Poison, which is Eleanor Anaya. Anaya? The woman from The Skin I Live In. Anyway, it just becomes a bit of a chase movie at that point, which I didn't really like him. I liked the idea of Dr. Poison, but I don't think they did anything particularly interesting with her.
They could have done something better with her.
Yeah, there could have been a lot of mirroring going on between her kind of plight and Diana's. You know, they're both these two women who in some way both being taken advantage of in
Perhaps could have got rid of Danny Houston's character and had her as the main
she seemed like the sidekick, you know, didn't she?
Yeah.
She couldn't be, though, is the thing, though, right? Because it's men who are in control is the sort of running theme through the film.
Yeah.
So she couldn't be the main villain, because within the kind of world of the film, she's not allowed to be, if you see. So I think they did what they had to do, but she was the more interesting character.
Yeah. Maybe in a more modernized or modern time set.
Yeah, possibly.
Film,
yeah.
They could possibly do that, but in the time set that the film was made in.
But I don't think it necessarily means the film's got nothing to say about the modern world. I think it just means that, you're right, because of the setting, then she was never going to be the captain. But, So one last point that I wanted to make, and I don't know if you guys have got anything else that you wanted to add. I thought, whilst watching it, that some of the excessive death scenes, and I thought they were kind of excessive, they just didn't sit particularly well with me. I think because it's based on a real war, for a start, and it uses real people in it, you know. Ludendorff himself is based on a real guy. I just thought it was a little bit tasteless. And I know that she's like a... effectively a soldier in this. She's a warrior. So Wonder Woman has to go around and stop the bad guys who she thinks are evil. But considering she like talks about the value of life and clearly believes in it so strongly, to then just go around slaying all these German soldiers with a sword, I don't know. That didn't really feel right. Did it bother any of you, or is that just a me?
Not really. I can see where you're coming from, but it didn't bother me.
No, for me.
No. Okay, fair enough.
I mean,
just me.
Yeah, perhaps if it was set World War II rather than World War I, there's more of a moral thing against the enemy in that, because neither World War I or World War II, the Germans were particularly nice people. But in World War II, you obviously got Hitler and the Final Solution,
the Nazis,
Holocaust,
yeah,
and Nazis. In World War I, from my limited understanding of history, World War I just seemed to be a massive dick-waving contest between all the powers of Europe, which really could have been avoided, especially as all the royal families of Britain, Russia and Germany were all bloody related anyway. It seems like a war that could have quite easily been avoided, and from what I know, Kaiser Wilhelm was pretty intent on going to war and having this war. Neither side were better or worse than each other because they all went to war for no real reason. Maybe if it's set in World War II, there would be more of a moral thing about the enemy than there was in World War I. But for no, for me, it didn't really. Yeah. Didn't really.
No. Okay. I thought, because like she had that poignant scene with James Cosmo where he says, oh, well, we'll just, soldiers die. That's what they do. And she was furious with him for saying that. That the fact that she then went to war and just started killing people left, right, and centre. Mm. Like, I know in Batman versus Superman, Batman killed people and people were pretty outraged by it. But mostly Batman in that film seeks to disarm unless, you know, whatever. But, like, it seems to be a thing that runs through these DC movies and that lots of innocent... I don't know if you can call them innocent because they were soldiers, but I think so. I think it's fair. Lots of innocent people are killed by the supposed good guys, whether intentionally or unintentionally. But in this film, there was a lot of intentionally.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Which just felt a bit... I mean, Wonder Woman in the comics has killed people in the past. It's not new. It just... I don't know. It just kind of rankled a little bit. But yeah. So, I mean, I haven't really got anything else that I wanted to add about the film other than I liked it, but as Steve said, it's not great.
Just that I loved it.
Time now for Triple Bill, where we pick our favourite three or three films from a certain topic. This week, given that we are doing this women's special, as... Sounds awful. Every time you say that, it sounds bloody awful.
I can't
awful,
say it. The women's special. We're giving women time on the podcast, aren't we? Great.
It's essentially what it is, yeah. Isn't it? There's no hiding from it. We're talking about Wonder Woman, which was starring, written and directed by women, and we're doing a triple bill based on films written and directed by women. So it is a women's... Yeah. It just sounds pretty shit when you say it out loud.
A women's special. There you go.
Yeah, there you go.
If you can edit the sarcasm out of my voice, then yeah.
Oh, God.
Anyway, so this triple bill, we have all picked three films written or directed by a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's it,
yes.
In a nutshell.
Yes.
Didn't have to pick your favourite, you could just pick any three, which is kind of what I ended up doing.
Okay, so why don't you start us off with your first one, Owen?
Right, okay. So, as I say, I didn't pick my three favourites. What I wanted to do was pick... three films that I hadn't seen before that were either written or directed by women. And so I didn't want to include any rewatches, not films I'd seen before. Otherwise, my list would have basically been, like, from the start, it would have just been The Love Witch by Anna Biller. It would have been Mary Harron's American Psycho and Jen and Sylvia Soska's American Mary. There we go. That would have been it. Done. But what I did was I purposely... went out and watched a bunch of films directed by women that I just either hadn't seen, hadn't heard of. I tried to find new things. And the first one that I'm going to talk about is... it's called The Slumber Party Massacre, which is from 1982. And it doesn't immediately scream like a film directed by women from the title, right? The Slumber Party Massacre, a 1982 slasher film. But it was directed by Amy Jones. I didn't know who Amy Jones was, I'll admit. So I looked at her IMDb and didn't recognise any of her other handful of features that she's directed since 1982 either. But, to be fair, she is probably minted because she wrote a relatively successful series of films. Bearing in mind, she wrote The Slumber Party Massacre. Well, she didn't write, she directed The Slumber Party Massacre. She wrote Beethoven and its four sequels. That's a mix, isn't it? That's not like a normal career path, I don't think. So yeah, she's probably well off anyway. But so the plot of Slumber Party Massacre doesn't involve a dog at all. It revolves around a group of high school girls who like getting naked around each other a lot. That's what I learned. So whether they're in the showers at school, whether they're changing clothes at home, or just, you know, doing what all blokes of that age like to think girls get up to on their sleepovers, you know, getting naked in front of each other and stuff. There is a lot of nudity in this. Actually, probably there's more nudity in this than I saw in Emmanuel in Space in 30 Minutes. That's how much nudity.
30 minutes of the bloody film.
Yeah, but it's a short film anyway. This is about 70 minutes, I think. But these girls like getting stoned. They like drinking and they like shagging their boyfriends, basically. And on one of their drinking, smoking, and shagging sleepovers that they have, there is a mental hospital patient who's escaped and is going around killing loads of girls with his big drill. Yeah.
Okay.
Its tagline is the ultimate driller killer thriller, which is, I think I thought I'd throw in there. I don't have any comment either way. If I didn't know that this was directed by a woman and written by a woman called Rita Mae Brown, I think I might not really have given it that much thought. But because it's just like one of these churned out, 50 of them a year that were produced in America kind of slasher films. But actually, there is something more to it, probably because of who the killer is. Because he's got a big drill and it's basically a big dick. He basically goes around fucking all these girls. That's what he does, He drills them with his massive drill. And the fact that he's also like a generic looking, he kills girls, but he's got no like standout qualities to him. He's got like no hockey mask. There's no like bloodstained apron. There's no red stripy jumper or anything like that. He's just
a big drill.
Yeah, a big drill and double denim. That's what he is. He's just an American man. And I think that therefore probably gives it a bit more credit than I would have done if I didn't know who was behind it. It just makes it a little bit more interesting, I think. Like, it's got a little bit more commentary to make about that. Because, the women are scared of this bloke, but they don't know who he is. He's just a bloke. He's an older, single-minded, kind of powerful and remorseless bloke who just goes around terrorising girls. I will say, it does kind of conform to a lot of conventions of slashers, particularly sort of that 1980, well, it's 1982, so that kind of era of slashers. It very much follows those sort of formula for them, for these kind of movies. But I did really like it. Ultimately, it is just a slasher. It definitely feels different. And I think the difference comes from the perspective, because it's so like askew compared to its contemporaries. Because normally you view it from like the killer's perspective, right? He's the one who goes around to all these houses. He's the one you're following. He's the one you're scared of. This is all from the girl's point of view. And there's just a guy with a drill who's going around killing lots of people. Mm. You see his face a couple of times, but it shows that it's ultimately unimportant. It's the idea that they're kind of scared of. So, yeah, The Slumber Party Massacre, 1982. First film down. And it was the first one that went onto the list. I thought I'm definitely picking this for the triple bill.
So for the women's special, Owen picks a film called The Slumber Party Massacre, featuring lots of naked teenagers in a big drill.
Yes, but that, like I tried to hopefully clarify, is the point.
I'm just trying to simplify things for the listeners.
Well, thanks. All right. Yeah, that's good.
I've picked three films of mine written by women, and also tried to pick three very different films. So the first one I picked was a reasonably recent film, just a couple of years old, and that was Room from 2015, written by Emma Donoghue, who wrote the book and adapted the book into the film, which was then directed by Lenny Abrahamson. I just found this film very, very gripping. I know there's been lots of films about people who have been kidnapped or abducted before, but it just seemed very different, perhaps because of the element of having the child in there, who was played really well by Jacob Tremblay. But yeah, I just found it very different to that, the usual kind of abduction or kidnapping film, a lot better than the usual type of film in that genre. Just very, very gripping and interesting, emotional. Obviously, it is a very difficult thing to adapt a book into a screenplay. Perhaps easier if it's your own book you're adapting, I don't know. But obviously, a lot of people try to turn books into films and it fails quite miserably, but not in this case.
I think it's also really good because the kidnapping part almost ends halfway through, and then there's much more afterwards.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes it different from other typical kind of kidnapped people films.
Yeah.
I really liked it. I just sat there with my... I don't know, I just sat there in awe the whole film. I loved it.
It is very kind of moving. And you're right, it's really uplifting in a weird sort of way.
Yeah.
Because they kind of discover life, don't they? They discover kind of happiness and you think,
yeah.
Oh yeah, this kid is really happy to just have his hair cut.
Yeah.
It's kind of like...
Trying to explain to people what the film's about makes it seem quite depressing.
Mm.
And then you're like, no, it's much more than that. It's not just this horrible thing where you're going to sit there and bore your eyes out. It's more. Yeah.
It is more.
Yeah, but that was Room. And Maya, what's your first pick?
My first pick, I'm going with a adaptation of a novel. And I'm going with, Owen mentioned it earlier, Mary Harron's American Psycho.
Yes.
Absolutely loved Bret Easton Ellis's novel. And... then when I watched the film, I just thought it was brilliant. I just think Christian Bale is just, he plays the Wall Street banker, Patrick Bateman, really, really well. You know, there's so much social commentary in there. I just think it's brilliant and it's really, really funny. I watched it again the other night and I forgot how much I laughed at it. You know, I thought, my God, why am I laughing at some of these points? But they were brilliant. She's also... directed TV episodes. I had a look at Mary Harron's IMDb page, and she'd done things like episodes in The Fallen and Constantine as well. And I really do, me, it's one of the books, it's one of the films where the book and the film are both brilliant. I know lots of people would disagree with me about the book being good, but I absolutely yeah. loved both.
It's quite a controversial book as well, isn't it?
Yes.
I can't remember the bit of trivia exactly. I might be wrong, but I think Christian Bale's mom was a like staunch feminist who like went to protest demonstrations about the book.
Oh wow!
And then years later, her son ended up starring in a remake of it.
Oh.
An adaptation of it, which I always think is kind of. A funny thing about it as well, because the kind of duality of the film is replicated in a mom who's a staunch feminist who opposed the book, and then her son became Patrick Bateman.
Yeah,
so it was a kind of funny.
It's just so
quirk.
Good. And Christian Bale was amazing in it, and I did. I just sit there thinking, this is brilliant. I love it, and I love the book as well.
Okay, so that was American Psycho. Owen, your second choice.
My second choice is a film called Night Moves, which came out in 2014. And it's written and directed by Kelly Reichardt, who I've mentioned a couple of times on the podcast in the past because she directed Meek's Cutoff, which is a Western about the Oregon Trail, which I've mentioned quite positively because I think it's a really good film. So Night Moves, I had this on DVD for ages. A friend bought it for me for Christmas the year before last. And it kind of stayed in the cellophane wrapping on the shelf. Even though I really liked Meek's Cutoff, I just never got around to watching Night Moves for whatever reason. And, you know, when we were doing this triple bill, I kind of saw it as an excuse of like, I want to watch lots of films by directors I haven't seen before. Films I haven't seen before by female directors. This came off the shelf and was unwrapped, put in the DVD player, and I did really enjoy it. It follows the same kind of thing as most of Kelly Reichardt's stuff, from what I gather. It was the same with Meek's Cutoff. Is it slightly difficult to get into? It doesn't want you to just jump straight in and go, oh yeah, this is fucking great. It's very... much like trying to run across nails. The story... well, I'll tell you who's in it first, I guess. A few people pop in and out of the film, but it's really only got three principal cast members. It's got Jesse Eisenberg, it's got Dakota Fanning and Peter Sarsgaard, and they are radical environmentalists, and they plan to blow up a hydroelectric dam in protest at energy waste that goes on in the world. So it's really, it's like an environmental film. That's kind of the themes in the background of it. But it is also a thriller. It's not funny at all. I don't think it tries to be funny. It's very dry. It's very slow. And the whole process of it coming together is also quite naturalistic, right? It doesn't have lots of orchestral scores going on in the background. Everything that happens within the kind of diegesis of the movie. It's all there. But I just think I really liked it for that. Because she made it so... I was going to say inaccessible, but that's not what I'm... because it's so... it's so indie for a start, but it's almost like it wants you to earn the right to enjoy it, if you see what I mean. So it's incredibly pretentious, but that's kind of how it feels, and I think it's worth the effort because it's such a good film. It's a great film, even. I would say it's a great film. I'm glad I have the DVD of it because I am definitely watching it again. But this is not a popcorn munching thriller. It's a slow, hard-working drama, which deals with consequences of your actions and stuff like that. That's what it's kind of about. Guilt, paranoia, the fallout of things that you do, the effect it has on people. Whatever your rationale, whatever your means, whatever your altruistic good that you think you're doing things for, there are consequences of your actions. And that's really what the film is about. So, Night Moves, that was from 2014. Fantastic movie.
So, my second choice then is... I've picked three different genres as well. So, my second choice is The Babadook, a horror film from 2014. Screenplay by and directed by Jennifer Kent. And I remember seeing this in the cinema, and it is... just really creepy, and while it's the same as a lot of horror films, it's a bit different as well. It's very well put together, very atmospheric. It's about basically a demon or whatever you want to call it from a children's story, but the mother's story, but he reads the child called Mr. Babadook, and it's kind of a monster, and it manifests itself as to kind of haunt or attack both mother and son. A lot of modern horrors, especially English language ones, this is either from Australia or New Zealand, I can't remember which.
Australian, I think.
But sort of they tend to be just sort of bog standard 15s, not overly pushing anything in terms of scares or atmosphere. A lot of jump scares and just real by the books. This one just seemed different, and it just seemed to have a lot more of a kind of an impact. You know, it just seemed to be a lot creepier and darker.
I've not seen that yet.
Did you think it was? I think one of the best things about it as a horror film is that it wasn't scary.
It wasn't scary so much, but it was definitely creepy. It definitely had a kind of atmosphere to it. It definitely built up quite well and. You know, but no, it wasn't scary. It wasn't like a film where you had jump scares jumping out of your seat, but it, yeah.
I think it's as much as it's a scary film as it's, I suppose, intended to be, I think it's actually about a kid who's too young to comprehend what his mom is going through.
Yeah.
Which is grief. And that's the Babadook. It's a made-up story for him to deal with what happens to his mom. And so I think it is a really intelligent film. It's very clever. Some people seem to hate it, and I'm never sure why. They get some real stick from people online. Mm. If you ever look at, like, Letterboxd and reviews of it, it just... Yeah, I don't get it. I don't get why people hate it. It's kind of a good psychological thriller.
Maybe they're expecting a more traditional kind of horror film when they... I don't know.
Mm.
Maybe, anyway, that was the Babadook. Maya, what's your second film?
My second choice is 2008 film Surveillance, directed by Jennifer Lynch. It's basically about two FBI detectives who are called to investigate a series of really brutal murders. They all take place in a remote, you know, the whole film basically takes place in the police station where they're interviewing witnesses and a story unfolds, and it is such a good thriller, and it was very creepy. You know, it's got Bill Pullman in it, who plays Agent Sam Holloway, and Julia Ormond, who plays Elizabeth Anderson, who's the other FBI agent, and it just unravels into this complete mindfuck style thriller. It is so good. Every time I watch it, I just sit there with my mouth open thinking, oh my god, this is horrible. It's one of those ones that makes you sit there thinking, what would I do if I was in that situation? How would I get away? You know, what would I... And it just makes you ask those questions, which sometimes is not a good thing. But yeah, Jennifer Lynch's Surveillance, and I think she's done things like Boxing Helena as well and Chained. But I thought she was quite a good director to pick because I really, really like Surveillance. And I think it's a film that not a huge number of people have seen. And I think it's one that you really do need to. It's not a slow burner. There are elements of paint by numbers when it comes to a thriller, but it's done so well. And the flashbacks into the story that the witnesses are telling and how each of the three stories or four stories kind of combine into the last act is just, I think it's very, very tense.
I've never seen it, but from what I know, and particularly the way you just described it then, it's like an updated version of Rashomon, isn't it? Where people talk about the different... Do you know the film Rashomon?
No, I don't know,
okay.
Sorry.
So there's a famous Japanese film, which was directed by Akira Kurosawa, and it basically lots of people tell the same story, but from their own perspective. And so everyone remembers things slightly different. And so... there's no conclusive one truth. It's just about, you know, lots of different ways of remembering things.
Similar to that. I think that there is, in Surveillance, there is that one truth. There is that one story, but it's the background is how each of the characters get to that story. And then you find out a little bit about each of the witnesses, the people who survived. And, you know, there's lots of it that you are watching through interrogation cameras where you can see the screens. And again, it kind of adds to that intensity and just the way that the two FBI agents are played by Bill Pullman and Julia Ormond are very, very good. And the little girl, Ryan Simpkins, who plays Stephanie, she's fantastic. And again, having another kid in a thriller movie is always going to creep me out a little bit more.
I've just seen that it had French Stewart in it as well.
Yes, yeah.
Yep, Harry from Third Rock from the Sun.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. I went, I know him from somewhere. Brooks was like, Third Rock from the Sun. Ah, yep, I know exactly who it is.
There we go.
Yeah, it's got Michael Ironside in it as well as Captain Billings, which is quite
sold.
Good. Another
sold.
One. Exactly, you know, it's his face and you recognise him and you're like, well, I know him, it's all good.
Okay, that is fair. So, in your final choice?
Because I've picked two films that have been directed by women, I thought I'd try and find one that's... see if there's something a bit different about ones that are written by women but directed by men. And so I found The Hand That Rocks the Cradle from 1992, which I hadn't seen before. Have either of you seen this?
No,
okay. It's quite interesting because I thought I knew what it was about before I'd seen it, and actually it was kind of different. So it's written by someone called Amanda Silver, but like I say, directed by a guy, Curtis Hanson. It very much is a psychological thriller about a woman who... Oh, well, I'll go right to the start of the story to begin with. You've got Annabelle Sciorra, whatever her name is. She basically plays a pregnant woman at the beginning of the film who registers with a new doctor's surgery, and the doctor tells her he wants to do a full physical examination of her because she's pregnant and she's new at the surgery. And so she says, okay. And he asks her to take her clothes off and get changed, and she does. She wears the gown. And he takes advantage of his position and fondles her breasts, and he then gives her an internal examination. But before he does that, he removes his rubber gloves. And so it's really the most... I mean, I watched it and thought, oh my God, this is really horrible. This is horrific. And I'm not even a woman, and I'm like, this is fucking horrendous. He's just basically fingering her on the table. And so she runs out of the room afterwards, after the examination, and she's like clearly distressed and everything. She goes, this is all in the first like 5 minutes of the film. She goes back home. She tells her husband what happens. They report the guy. They report the doctor. And what happens is the report goes public, and more women start to come out and say, oh, yes, he did the same thing to me. So it's like, so the start of it is, I thought, the film is going to be about, there's this woman who's been abused by a guy. That's what it is. That's what the story's going to be. And then, like, still within the first 5 minutes, he shoots himself in the head and he's dead. I'm like, oh, right. Okay. So is that resolved? What's happening now? What happens next is you see the doctor's wife, which is Rebecca De Mornay, who plays Peyton, or the wife of Dr. Mott, who's John Delancey, by the way. The doctor was John Delancey. So I saw him in this and I was like, oh, great. I like John Delancey. No, John Delancey, what are you doing? Fuck it. But, you know, so it goes back to this story now where Rebecca De Mornay, as Peyton, as the doctor's wife, is also pregnant. She learns about what's happened to her husband. He's killed himself. His estate is held by the bank. They won't release any of the money to her because it has to go to all these libel suits. She then miscarries and the baby dies. And so the story then becomes one of revenge. You get Peyton, who's the wife of the guy who abused another woman, who is getting revenge on that woman. And so I just thought this was actually really good. I mean, like I say, it completely twisted around what I thought was going to happen. And kind of what I thought the film was about. Because it just, I mean, it's a little bit bunny boiler. It is a little bit like a bunny boiler story. She's in there and she's trying to take over and destroy their life, but in a really cruel and calculated way, which I guess is typically like associated with what women would be terrified of rather than men. Because what she starts to do is she, like, this is like cuts forward to about 9 months, and she becomes the nanny for the baby.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So she's in the house, she's in the family, and she starts like breastfeeding the baby so that the baby then doesn't want to be fed by its mum, because the baby's always been fed already. She tries to like seduce the husband. She kind of plants these seeds of doubt into Annabelle Ciora's mind that her husband's having an affair with her best friend, who's Julianne Moore, in what is, I think, Julianne Moore's first feature film. She convinces them that again, by just carefully manipulating the situation, that this guy who's from, he's kind of a bit mentally challenged, this fella, Ernie Hudson, you know, Winston from Ghostbusters, he's there, he helps to build the fence and paint the fence and stuff, but he's got like the mind of a 9-year-old. She convinces her that Ernie Hudson's character is touching up her other daughter, and she plants her daughter's underwear in Ernie Hudson's toolbox, so he gets caught. It's really like properly like, oh my God, this is gripping. This is like, this is terrifying, but it's all from, I think that's what was quite interesting about it. It's all these horrors that you would associate of if you were a mom and someone came into your life and what they were doing to you. And it's so fucking twisted. I liked it a lot. I really liked it. It falters a little bit towards the end. But I think it's really tightly plotted. It's kind of episodic because each thing that happens is told almost as like its own little story. It's got a really tense opening. The performances in it are great, especially Rebecca De Mornay as Peyton. I think she really plays this horribly manipulative woman really well. I can see why it's got its reputation. It is a little bit trashy, I think. Just a little bit, just a touch trashy. But again, kind of plays on the whole idea of vulnerability and stuff like that. I thought it was great. The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, if you've never seen it before and you think you kind of know what it is, watch it. It's really good. Okay. Really fun.
Yeah. Okay, that's The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. My final choice. So I went for a comedy this time. Comedy written by Kay Cannon, who has also worked for the likes of 30 Rock and New Girl. And it is Pitch Perfect. Now, a lot of people probably wouldn't think Pitch Perfect would be the kind of film I would watch. And you're probably right, but I wouldn't say it's one of my girlfriend's favourite films, but it's one of those films that she can just watch over and over when she wants to watch a film that she's going to enjoy. Probably like I do with Star Wars, that kind of enjoyable film. So she put it on one day and I watched it for the first time. And I found it really funny. And, you know, the musical numbers in it aren't too bad. They're well choreographed, put together. I don't know how much the writer or the screenplay had to do with that. But the actual film is actually really funny. The sequel, not so much, which you also had a hand in. There's a third film coming out this year as well, I believe. But no, it's a really, really funny film, which some people might not expect or might not be thinking of when they go to watch it, or not thinking not of watching it at all. No, I really enjoyed it.
It almost made my list of things to watch that I hadn't seen before. If it was on Netflix, I probably would have. I think Pitch Perfect 2 is on Netflix.
Yeah,
which is directed by Elizabeth Banks.
It might be on Sky Go.
Okay. And
I don't know.
But it almost made... If it would have been there, I would have watched my bunch of films. But
unfortunately, it's good fun.
I've not seen it.
And Maya, what's your final choice?
I've gone for something a bit more lighthearted than my last two choices. I've gone for Clueless.
Okay.
Written and directed by Amy Heckerling. I think it is. Well, not I think. I know it is one of my favourite films, and especially my favourite kind of chick flick type of film. I'm not into chick flick style films often, but I do like this one, and this one is one that I will watch over and over and over again and laugh and giggle. It's just brilliant. It's a 1995 film about a little socialite teen called Cher, played by Alicia Silverstone, and she finds Brittany Murphy's Ty Fraser's a little project to make over and teach her about being educated and being, you know, kind of more grown up than she actually is. I love it because it just covers all the typical teen issues that you do see in those kind of films, you know, finding who you are, the coming of age, sex, stereotypes. I love the bit, you know, it's a film that really started to comment on teenagers with mobile phones quite a lot. And it's very, very fitting now, I think. I think my favourite thing from Clueless, and I'm that sad that I've even watched the special features. I know, it does have special features. But actually watched the special features on the language where Amy Heckerling actually made up as well as used some of the slang and colloquial terms that you see in the film. She did a ton of research where she would collect loads of articles and books on colloquial language and teenage speak and slang, and she actually created some words and phrases that they use in Clueless from scratch and from what, you know, from 50s. I think a lot of it was from the 50s style. She used the Flintstones at the idea of calling someone a Barney or a Betty. And But I absolutely love it. It's one of my, I won't say guilty pleasures because I'm not guilty. I don't feel guilty ever watching it. It is just one of my ultimate, I love this film. And I don't think, at whatever age, I think I'm always going to love it. And, you know, the teenager in me just sits there grinning. You know, the bits where she describes every single, like, teenage group. The layabouts, the rich kids, the, you know, the geeks that are in charge of the TV station and things like that. Just, I love it. It's so good. I teach it quite often, actually. When I get a chance, any chance I get, I will teach it. I absolutely love it.
And that was Clueless.
So we also had some really great recommendations through on Twitter, actually. We had Thomas at Simi41 suggested Point Break, American Psycho as well. Green Street as well. He says, I love it. Okay. He also recommended Blackfish and Monster, which is obviously by Patty Jenkins, director of Wonder Woman. Brooker, we know Brooker. He recommended American Mary and Dead Hooker in a Trunk from the Soska Twins. Truth or Dare from Jessica Cameron, which we reviewed a couple of weeks back. You know, Hurt Locker, Zero Dark Thirty and Near Dark, which I thought would come up more, but they didn't. Also said The Babadook, he said Pet Sematary, Punisher Warzone, also said Green Street and Point Break. He also said A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, which was also suggested by the Sudden Double Deep podcast, at SDD Film Podcast on Twitter, which is a great recommendation. I suggest people go out and track that down if they've not seen it already. It used to be on Netflix, I don't know if it still is. Steve F, at Upper Tier Steve, on Twitter, suggested Wayne's World, which is great, Strange Days and Ravenous. Movies Now and Then, at Movies Now Then, on Twitter. Eve's Bayou, which I hadn't heard of, but they said it was one of Roger Ebert's favourites. It's a Southern American gothic tale with a flair for the mystical, which I thought sounded quite interesting. Elab, at Elab49, suggested Hitchhiker is currently on Mubi. If that's any use, and the highest in my top 100, she said. So, fantastic. Don't know what that is, but I'm going to look into it for sure. And finally, we had Chris Wallace, at Chris Wallace 123 of Wikishuffle and Goodnight Sweetcast fame. I don't know what's happened to those podcasts, but anyway, so he said, I have a soft spot for Jennifer's Body. People might question my taste, and then highlighted Jack. From Wikishuffle, but Lost Boys-ish 80s cheesy strippers heels is my thing. So, yeah, can't argue with those. So thanks very much for all your suggestions on Twitter.
Okay. To end the podcast, we're going to go with some recommendations for the week ahead. I'm going to go with something I have seen on Netflix, new to Netflix, and that is the documentary titled Gascoigne, about the enigmatic former England Newcastle, Tottenham and Lazio footballer Paul Gascoigne, made by the same people who made the Amy Winehouse documentary, and a very interesting look at one of football's more colourful and troubled personalities.
Yeah, I think I picked this a couple of weeks ago when it went on.
Did you?
And you, I think so, and I think you even said the same thing then, that it was a good documentary.
Well, watch it again. I thought it was only new to Netflix this week from what I saw. I hadn't seen it on there before. Anyway, I don't listen to what you say often, do I say? what are you telling people to watch?
On Thursday, on Film 4, Thursday night / Friday morning, 25 past midnight, is The Raid on Film 4. And then on Friday evening at 10:45 is The Raid 2. So, over 2 days, you can watch two of the best modern action films that have been made anywhere.
There you go. And Maya?
Mine is on Friday nights on 5 Star, 10 past 10, is Neil Blomkamp's Elysium.
Right.
So yes, that is all for this week's Failed Critics podcast, except for Owen not remembering what we're doing next week.
Oh, well, you say that, but next week is The Mummy, Steve.
Ah.
The first in the Universal Monsters extended universe, which is a thing. Mm. Did you know that?
I knew it was happening, yes.
Mm. The Mummy with Tom Cruise.
not as the Mummy.
Well, we'll see. Maybe.
Yeah.
But it is the start of the Universal Monsters movie universe. All the old characters they had. Dracula. Well, actually, I don't think they've cast a Dracula yet, but they've got Russell Crowe as Dr. Jekyll, I saw.
Oh, interesting.
Which will be quite
interesting. And he's in the Mummy, isn't he?
Yes, he is, yeah.
So, yes, that's interesting. I think Frankenstein's monster.
That was Javier Bardem.
Yeah, let's get that right. Not Frankenstein, Frankenstein's monster. Or someone will be
that's
on
right.
Twitter.
Yeah.
Not Frankenstein, Frankenstein's monster.
I was about to tell you that, but I won't now.
Yeah. Yeah, what else? They've got werewolves or something, probably.
They've cast someone else, but I can't remember who. Oh, it's Johnny Depp as the Invisible Man. They need to bring in the Creature from the Black Lagoon. That's the best one.
So anyway, yes, that's next week. So thank you all for listening. Head over to the website. Owen's got his review of Wonder Woman on there, which is well worth a read, as well as other stuff. And we'll be back next week.
The Failed Critics Podcast is presented by Steve Norman and Owen Hughes, with contributions from different guests every week, with original music provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com from the track The Bandit, remixed by James Yule, who you can find at jamesyule.com. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Failed Critics, on iTunes and all good podcast apps, or you can check us out at failedcritics.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and leave a rating or a review. And why not check out our sister podcasts, Character Unlock and Field and Mullinger's Underground Nights, from the Failed Media Network of Podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.